We're recording now.
Okay. Yeah. Well, I'm prepared this time because you forgot to turn the microphone on or something.
Shut up. They didn't need to know that. Stop breaking the fourth wall.
Well, you know.
Are there walls in podcasting? I'm not sure. Can we use stage terminology?
Audio wall.
Oh, the audio wall.
Probably not.
Welcome to the Right Dishonourable, dear listener. My name's Jazza.
My name's Jimmy.
And we talk about politics and social issues and current events every week.
I'm disappointed you didn't do your Maggie Thatcher voice.
Oh, I'm sure it'll come up at some point.
Yeah.
Yeah. Can the news stop, please?
I think we've finished, the news for this summer, more or less.
Yeah, I kind of just want to hibernate for a while, and for there not to have anything happen for a while. We have a new Prime Minister, or we will have a new Prime Minister. We're recording this on Tuesday evening, and Theresa May has now been anointed the next Prime Minister of the United Kingdom.
This is probably the last 24 hours of David Cameron's premiership, although by the time you listen to it, it'll be even less.
There may be negative hours of his premiership left. Basically, over the weekend, Andrea Leadsom came under a lot of fire, didn't she? She had a bit of a rough time. We'll talk a little bit about that article in the Times where she was like, I'm better at being a leader because I am a lady with children. I told you that Margaret Thatcher voice would come out at some point because posh Tory women are involved. And then the backlash kind of made her quit. And so 199 MPs have chosen who our next Prime Minister is going to be.
I mean, in some ways, you could argue it's, the handful of journalists who write for the Times who chose our Prime Minister.
That one journalist who decided to actually report it, and the editor who decided to put it on the front page, they decided our next Prime Minister.
There you go.
Brilliant. So we're going to be talking about that this week.
And in other very current events, Jeremy Corbyn is potentially not going to appear on the ballot paper for the next Labour leadership election that is ongoing.
Or might actually end up automatically on the ballot for the new Labour leadership election is happening.
Literally while we record this, and events could change during
the, I've got during my recording. Phone still on, and hopefully the BBC will notify us
There's a National Executive Committee in Labour who are deciding on this very important matter.
Yeah.
When they rewrote the leader rules badly, they didn't, phrase it clearly.
This is basically after Angela Eagle has decided to put her name forward as a potential leader for the Labour Party and challenge Jeremy Corbyn.
Do you think the Lib Dems should have a leadership election? It's very fashionable these days. The Greens are having one as well.
Yeah, literally everyone except for the SNP and the Lib Dems are now having a leadership election. I am not Tim Farron's biggest fan, as I've said many times, but nah. There's eight of them, and they're all straight white men. They're all from basically the same background. They're all pretty much the same.
Well, the Lib Dems are a sectional middle-class party, Jazza. That's what it's all about.
Yeah, and at least 50% of the middle class are women. Hugely representative.
I've heard. Yeah.
allegedly. When have you ever seen a woman down the pub?
Can I get a citation for that?
Yeah.
I'm not entirely sure I'm convinced.
So we're just going to talk about these two topics this week because too much news is happening and we can't really
be bothered
to do anything in. Oh, honourable mention, just in case we don't talk about it, Stephen Crabbs is sexting.
We probably will talk about that.
Will we?
We should also mention
I'm not sure how we're going to tie that in, but I just think it's brilliant that a man who's like, oh yes, I'm really into religious and family values, is actually having some WhatsApp sex on the side.
I mean,
anyway, on that note,
the Chilcot.
You always ruin my segment.
I'm sorry. The Chilcot report also happened. Tony Blair's a nasty man. We might mention that in more detail.
Yeah, we were going to have somebody on this week who was going to have more of an opinion on it than us. Am I safe to say that you're in the same boat as me? Did you greet the Chilcot inquiry with a bit of a shrug?
So far as I understand, which is not very much, as per usual, but we didn't really learn anything new. All the commentators were like, we knew all this already, so
Nah.
Should we play the music?
Yeah,
the podcast?
Just for the record, we're not talking about Chilka. It's going to be Prime Minister May and Bye Bye Corbyn. Those are the that can be our title. Okay, music. Bye.
Andrea Leadsom gave
or Leadsom
or Leadsom
gave who knows who cares
gave,
anymore
gave an interview. You just totally fucked up my intro anyway. However you pronounce her name, she gave an interview to the Times where she said that being a mother made her a better candidate than Theresa May, who had in the last week talked about her difficulties conceiving, and in the end she hasn't actually been able to have children. So obviously this was a very sensitive issue, and Andrea Leadsom, in touching upon it, caused a huge ruckus. She said that she'd been misquoted. The Times then released the full transcript and then audio recording of the interview. And in some ways, they were nicer about it than they might necessarily have been.
Although, in her defence... I can't believe I'm defending her. But in her defence, she did say, I don't want this to be a statement that basically says, I would be better at prime minister because I'm a mum, and then continue to then
to say that, yeah.
I would be better because I have children and therefore I'm more invested directly in the future of the country.
I mean, PR 101, if you say to a journalist, as has been said to me before on occasion, this isn't a story, obviously your immediate thought is going to be, oh, well, this is obviously a story, you know.
But I've listened to... I can't remember the name of the journalist who did this
piece. I think it's Rachel Sylvester is the name of the Times journalist.
Great, I will take your word for that. She said she apparently just thought that it wasn't a very nice thing to say and didn't think that it would be the front page, didn't think it would be such a big thing, and certainly didn't think that it would be a story that would end up deciding who our next Prime Minister was going to be. You talked about PR here, and isn't that really the biggest problem with Leeds and Lebs and Lumlum? Isn't that the problem with her, that she was so untried and tested in, like, being able to engage with journalists and being able to put her point across properly? She was so untested and so and lacked so much experience that she really wasn't the best person for the role. And it would have been a little bit shit if she'd become Prime Minister.
I don't know that was the main problem with her. I mean,
what do you think was the main problem with her?
Oh, she's a bit of a crazy, isn't she?
Yeah,
she I wouldn't say she faked her CV necessarily, but she presented it in a misleading
way. Just very generous
of you. Well, you know, I try and be nice to politicians.
Do you remember what she said on her CV that was so exaggerated?
She said she was an investment banker, and it is true that she was involved in banking, but it emerged over time. Various colleagues, I think she worked for Barclays, I think that's correct.
Brilliant institution.
She was essentially an administrator of sorts. She negotiated things like pay, like employee pay and that sort of thing. She wasn't involved in the banking side. It'd be like a receptionist for Barclays saying, oh, I'm an investment banker.
The sexist slurs have been coming out already.
I didn't assume a receptionist was female. That's what you did.
Yeah, actually, bet I'm a raging.
Yeah, sorry.
Raging
okay, a porter or some sort of internal courier, or you know, any role.
The head of HR.
Who would probably be a woman as well.
Oh dear.
Yeah,
well,
I'm sorry.
Sweeping statements.
Yeah.
Do you think that actually we've dodged a bullet here? Because there were, even though Theresa May was the favourite, there were whispers of Andrea Leadsom, because she looks like a lot of the Tory membership, there were fears of the fact that she might actually do particularly well if there were a ballot between the two ladies.
But the trouble is, at this point, all of the... everyone said, oh, Donald Trump won't be, you know, the Republican nominee for the president. They said the UK won't vote for Brexit. They said Ed Miliband will probably tie to David Cameron in the general election 2015 in the UK. And a lot of these things have gone wrong. So I'm not saying every election will go wildly in the opposite direction to what we think it will in the near future, but there's an element of uncertainty.
Not guilty of that. That was a double negative and very confusing. We've definitely held all of those views that you just said at some point.
Yeah, yeah, for sure. Yeah. But we tend to just, by and large, go with what the mainstream predict. And
maybe we need to, like, go against the curve.
What, every time?
Yeah.
It would be interesting if, like, someone went back and used, like, the rule of thumb, go against, on all political elections and referendums and whatnot, go against what the mainstream think. See how often you get it right.
Yeah. And could probably make a fair bob on the betting markets there as well.
Yeah, potentially. No.
So we had...
Can I ask a question?
Of course you can.
The whole, like, motherhood thing.
Yeah.
Does being a parent actually make you better at any job, conceivably?
It definitely gives you a different perspective. I think better is probably not a great word to use in this sense, but it would certainly change your perspective.
Is it true that it... I mean, being a parent compared to not being a parent must emphasise certain bits of your personality and skills and whatnot, and not being a parent, you know, emphasises other bits of it. So could it be the case, actually, that, I mean, everyone was in a fuss about it because motherhood and politics and motherhood and working women is very sensitive anyway... Mm-hmm. Did lead to whether or not you think what she said was despicable, is there a point in there somewhere?
I don't think that being a mother would make her a better prime minister. I think it would make her a different prime minister, in that everybody's life experiences dictate the kind of attitude they have towards life. And so that, of course, would make her... It shapes the person that she is, and so in that sense, it is going to make her a different kind of prime minister, perhaps. But I don't think that to say that I'm a mother and therefore I will be better because I'm the thing that I had issue with was that she said, and therefore I'm invested in the future of this country, which I think is like as if Theresa May is just going to like blow the lot of the British economy just because she doesn't have to pass on it onto the next generation. I think that that's a ridiculous argument to make.
I agree, yeah.
No, excellent.
Yes.
Oh, God, are we agreeing? It's terrible whenever that happens. Speaking of mothers and ladies in general, we never really got a chance to talk about the fact that there were two ladies on the ballot. Or we did, very briefly, at the end of the podcast.
I think we suggested that it was probably going to happen, because last podcast, it was looking as though that it was going to be a Leeds-May contest.
Yeah. Do you think that that was significant in any way, shape or form, and do you think it's going to be significant that we're going to have a female prime minister?
Well, there's been a lot of feminist commentators who've written about this phenomenon, that there were two Tory leadership contenders and now we've got a second female prime minister. And I think the consensus is it's not a feminist thing, because the Tories, even though they've embraced certain norms within feminist rhetoric and feminist thinking, by and large, they don't give a shit. I mean, correct me if I'm wrong. That's just my... I don't think the Tories agonise over women representation in the way that Labour do.
I would agree that they don't agonise about it, but I don't think... I think that they see that there's two women at the top, two women vying for the biggest job in the UK, and they went, oh, isn't that good? And then there's not a lot of, like, self-congratulation. Whereas I think that Labour would probably be more inclined to, because they work specifically towards those kinds of goals in raising women's status and voices, sometimes artificially through all-women shortlists.
So why have Labour not produced a full-time leader, then?
Yeah, it's crazy. I don't know.
No explanation whatsoever.
Because I genuinely don't know. Because they're meant to be doing... there are, of course, far more female Labour MPs than there are Conservative MPs. But the...
Conservative female MPs.
Yeah. Thanks. But they're... the proportions of men to women in the UK Parliament increased from about a quarter to a third in the last election. That had nothing to do with Labour. It had everything to do with the SNP. And the SNP has a much more diverse, balanced kind of representation in terms of the people that it sends to Westminster than the other traditional parties. And I think that has a lot to do with the long history that they have and people who are seen to have done their dues and the old white crusty men who are seen to deserve to still be MPs.
So you're saying the Tories are more hierarchical than Labour in that sense?
I think that the Tories and Labour are both equally hierarchical. And because of that, that holds them back to a certain extent, because there's a load of old white men still hanging around like a really bad smell.
It's a bit harsh.
I mean, they often do smell.
White men or old men?
Both. Why discriminate against one or the other when you can do both, Jimmy?
Harsh.
Yes. Do you think that it's significant in any way that we are going to have a female Prime Minister?
Not really, because we've proved that we could do it before. And I don't think she's going to govern as a particularly feminist Prime Minister, as it goes.
What would you consider a feminist Prime Minister?
Well, if someone like Stella Creasy became Prime Minister, the Labour MP who identifies as a feminist, often talks about feminist issues, contributes to the everyday sexism movement in certain ways, is far more active generally in talking about those issues and campaigning on those issues, she would make it far more of a priority if she was Prime Minister to pursue things like equal board representation on company boards, and ensure that there's more women in politics as well. Theresa May might do a bit of that, but I don't think it's going to be very central to her programme.
I certainly am not aware of anybody calling her particularly feminist in her role as the Home Secretary.
I should say I've actually just thought of a counterpoint to what I just said. In that,
counter yourself.
She put together this women. It was a campaign called Women to Win within the Tory Party, which was explicitly to get female MPs female candidates into Parliament, into the House of Commons. So she does have that history, admittedly, but I still don't think it will actually influence her programme very much.
As the Home Secretary for 6 years, she definitely didn't seem like she had like a feminist agenda. I'm not sure how feminist you can be in the Home Office. I want to pivot to her role as the Home Secretary, because she's the longest serving Home Secretary in modern times, at least. Do you think... But the thing is, despite the fact that she's been in that role and she's been at the forefront of politics for a really long time, she's been in the shadow cabinet since 1997, I think. Maybe even earlier. Or maybe 2001. She's been in the shadow cabinet at least for a long time. and then became the Home Secretary. But amongst a large number of journalists and pundits, nobody really seems to have a clue about her. What do you think she's going to govern like? Because everyone's a bit like, oh, she's competent.
I think she gives off an impression of competence, but I think that's far more illusory than you'd necessarily think if you read the commentary around her. Like, one of the main things during her tenure as Home Secretary that she's been responsible for is reducing migration.
Mm-hmm.
And migration has gone up and up and up.
Yeah.
Some of that is...
She did do those racist vans, though, quite fun.
She did do the racist vans.
Yeah, brilliant.
Which apparently didn't work. You know?
Yeah.
The migrants didn't go home.
Yeah.
Which is surprising, but... some of that isn't really to do with her, it's to do with like the economic situation in the Eurozone, which is shit, and the open borders between the UK and the rest of the EU, which allows people, and the general strength of the UK economy in relation to the Eurozone, none of which is her fault. But she also didn't massively lower migration from outside the EU, which was within her competency. She could have done something about that, she chose not to. And yet she appears to have escaped any substantial criticism for it. Mm-hmm. Which is impressive, but if that's one of your main... And people say that the border force in general in the UK has actually been underfunded during her tenure. I don't know how true that is, and I don't know how much of that has to do with budgetary cuts in general. But I think there's a lot of very legitimate questions about the migration thing, and that's even before you go on to stuff like the Snoopers Charter, which is generally a disaster and displays and was written by people who... It was either written by people who do understand the internet and then fed to the Home Office, who don't understand the internet, evidently, and then put before the Commons, because it asks you to... Essentially, it asks all computer companies or software companies to make their software insecure.
So I believe that that's not the case anymore. I believe it got edited. Can you explain what the Snoopers Charter is for anybody who doesn't
know? When I last looked at the Snoopers Charter, which... I think it was back in March. It's called the Investigatory Powers Bill, and it allows the it obliges telecoms companies to actually, and internet service providers, to hold a certain amount of data about what you do on the internet, and then give access to the police and to law enforcement if they're investigating something. There were various controversies about like the mechanism for police accessing that, like what the legal protections would be, whether they'd have to go to a judge and get the warrant approved and all of that sort of stuff. The thing I was talking about with the...
But this is specifically something that May has been a champion of.
Yeah, it's one of May's like main achievements as Home Secretary. I think it's just in the process of being passed. I'm not entirely sure where it is, but it slipped sort of underneath the radar, appropriately enough for a snooping bill.
very good.
While all of this Brexit for all has been ongoing, and one of the main problems with it, at least when I last looked at it, you've said it's changed, but so far as I'm aware, that hasn't happened. Is that?
Are you calling me a liar?
I'm not calling you a liar. I'm just saying I'm saying I'm not sure. The main problem with it is that it asks software companies to put in backdoors, as they're called, into software. So say you've got like WhatsApp, which the traffic between you and your friend is encrypted when you send a message. The security services want WhatsApp to
basically provide a key so that they can then unencrypt all of the messages.
So that they can get into it. Which also, it's very difficult to do that from a technical point of view without allowing hackers and cyber criminals and foreign spies to actually do the same thing. Mm-hmm. Because you're building in a weakness to the software.
You mentioned Brexit.
Okay.
Brexit, though a buzzword, hasn't happened yet.
It hasn't.
What do you think... And the reason, in case you don't know, dear listener, is because we have to trigger something called Article 50 from the Lisbon Convention, which would then trigger a 2-year negotiation period, after which we would actually leave the European Union.
Yes.
It should be noted that there are European parliamentary elections in 2019.
2017.
2019.
But the French and German ones are next year, aren't they?
The European parliamentary elections are in 2019. The French and German general elections, where they the French choose their new president and the Germans elect a new Bundestag, they are going to have their elections in 2017. And it is very possible that if Article 50 has been triggered before, then that... the British negotiation becomes a part of the election campaigns for our two biggest allies, competitors,
well,
rivals.
They're the two biggest states in the EU, mm-hmm. other than, well, you could argue France is smaller than the UK, but the UK is obviously leaving, so yeah. It's kind of a moot point.
So there is this debate as to when and if Article 50 gets triggered. Do you think... So, first of all, do you think that Theresa May is going to trigger Article 50? You can give that as a simple yes or no answer if you like, or you can elaborate. It's up to you. And two, if she does trigger it, under what conditions do you think she's going to trigger it?
No, right, I'll answer both at the same time.
Brilliant, you efficient so-and-so.
During the course of her premiership, I think she will trigger Article 50. She's already said it won't be this year, although that was said under the presumption that she wouldn't be elected as Prime Minister or Tory leader until September. But I still don't think she'll trigger it this year. I'm not really sure how the German and French elections play into that, because...
But they're going to have to take a tough stance against the UK.
Yeah, but at some point during the negotiations, there will be, you know, there's 27 other member states in the EU. Somebody is going to be having an election at some point during the negotiations. I mean, it's not ideal that it's France and Germany, but in many ways, every member of the EU has an equal say in Brexit.
Mm-hmm.
All 27 of them. Because... I think it's put through the Council of Ministers, and it's all done on a one-vote basis, isn't it?
You can't deny that the two most powerful members of not just the European Union but the Eurozone are entering into an election period where we are probably going to be one of the main talking points.
But I think we're going to be one of the main talking points whether or not we've invoked Article 50.
Mm-hmm.
There's definitely a case for delaying it until after those elections. I wouldn't dispute that,
but then, if we wait until after the 2017 elections for Germany and France, then we are still in the European Union when the 2019 European parliamentary elections happen, and then technically we would still be in our right to send 70 or so MPs to Brussels to represent the British people.
Sure, but that's largely a matter of convention, really, isn't it? I mean, we've sent our European Commissioner, because every member state nominates a commissioner, which then goes to work, who then goes to work for the European Commission.
They essentially function as a head of, as a head of state. It's kind of a cabinet position.
Similar to a cabinet, but it's a cabinet that sits directly onto a civil service rather than the civil service.
So previously, we had the we sent a lady who was the equivalent of the Foreign Office Minister. And this time around, we had the finance minister. And he's stepped down and is now been replaced by a guy from Estonia, I believe.
Yeah, so the finance brief is no longer with Britain, but we have nominated a replacement. But what he'll actually do during his time at the Commission, probably not very much, realistically.
Unless she doesn't invoke Article 50.
So this has been going around.
I'm clinging to this with dear hope.
So there's a couple of things, like, I've heard a lot of commentators saying, oh, it'll never happen, we'll never invoke Article 50, on the assumption that if we don't do that, we'll still be in the EU. And there's a couple of lawsuits going through the courts at the moment, which are basically trying to get a court to test the proposition that Article 50 cannot be invoked until the House of Commons have had a vote on it.
So there's also 1,000 lawyers wrote to, which actually isn't that big a number, so I don't know why I'm mentioning it, but I've started now anyway. 1,000 lawyers have written to the Prime Minister to say that he should really think about the fact that the vote to leave the European Union was advisory rather than binding in any way, shape or form. But he's only around for another 24 hours or so, so...
Yeah, but the fact it was advisory... I went through and, like, looked back at all of the referendums we've had in Britain, and all of them, whichever way the vote has gone, even if it's gone by a very small margin, as was the case with the Scottish devolution referendum in 1999, I think. It was like 51% to 49% or something. They've all been followed through. And all of those referendums, I think, have been advisory, apart from the Scottish one. The Scottish independence referendum was not advisory, as far as I'm aware. That's just a constitutional quirk, really. It's not a substantive point.
So, obviously, if I were Theresa May, I'd love wearing those kitten heels.
I think you could pull them off now, to be honest.
I've got hairy toes. I'd look terrible. I'd have to prepare first. But I obviously would choose to not mention Article 50 and hope that everybody forgot about it. If you were Theresa May, seeing as you wanted to leave the European Union, bastard, when would you choose to trigger it? When do you think would be the best time?
As I said, I think there's a case for leaving it until after the German-French elections, but probably as soon as possible, ideally. Like, lay that. Because what they need to do is they need to prepare some sort of plan in terms of what they're going to ask for, what sort of deal they're going to push for. They need to get the feelers out and actually see what all of the 27 members are feeling about this and get some sort of idea before negotiations start. But the Europeans in general have been very hostile to any official formal talks before Article 50 is invoked. So I don't think that will go very far. I think there's a limited amount you can do before you invoke Article 50.
What does Brexit look like for you? Because Theresa May has been quoted widely as saying Brexit means Brexit. The thing is, Brexit means many different things to many different people. Some of them include us in the free market. Some of them include us still with free movement. Some of them include other things. Anything else. What would Brexit mean to you, seeing as you're a vaguely sensible human being who voted to leave?
So what May said, maybe I'm not that sensible, given that I didn't vote to leave, but what May said was that for her, immigration, as in stopping free movement of people, is more important than access or participation in the single market. And this is the crux of the argument. Can we participate in the single market without free movement? All of the Europeans have said no. Basically, Angela Merkel went well out of her way to say this is not happening. So I think the way it's going to look when assuming Article 50 does get invoked, which I think it will, is we're going to be out of the single market. Now, what arrangements we have to trade with the single market, whether we're doing it purely on World Trade Organization tariffs, which I think initially is the most likely option, or whether in the medium term we negotiate some sort of special access, I don't know. But I think we're going to be at the single market. That seems to me to be the most likely thing, given what Theresa May said.
Cool. What would you do if you were Theresa May, dear listener? Tweet us at Right Dishonour, or leave us a comment on rightdishonourable.com.
I'll tell you what, I should ask you something in return. Would you, bearing in mind that if we were part of the EEA, the European Economic Area, we participate fully in the single market in a kind of Norway scenario, we'd be paying all the usual money to the EU, or most of it anyway. We'd have to follow all of the rules, but we wouldn't actually get a say in writing those rules. Would you still prefer that to non-membership, like complete disaffiliation from the EU?
Yeah.
Interesting.
Because the amount of industry that relies on that single market is huge. It's a huge part of our biggest industry, which is the finance industry. I still want to have the right to move and live around the European Union. It would be the closest thing to maintaining my European citizenship, which I'm going to end up losing, and you will end up losing. I think that that is, in the long term for the UK, well, no, maybe not in the long, long term, but at least in the short term, the best idea for the UK. But I just wouldn't invoke Article 50.
I have to say, in general, I don't think us being a part of the EEA is sustainable in the long term, because just for political reasons, I don't think British people would eventually say we need to just rejoin the EU. It's kind of dumb, or we need to leave.
No, but do you not think that we need reasonably high levels of immigration in this country, especially at the moment, because we have an ageing population and we a large public sector that requires them?
No, because in the long term, migration doesn't solve the demographic problem, because the longer people stay, the longer migrants stay in a country, and the larger the diaspora, various diasporas build up, the higher number of dependents come over, by which I mean non-working spouses, children, elderly relatives, and eventually you have the same problem. Migration is not a long-term solution to demographic difficulties.
What country do you think that we end up looking like?
In general, because of the EU thing, or...?
As a country outside of the single market, as you want, what country do you think that we end up emulating?
Probably America, really.
Great. On that note, we'll talk about Labour next. Follow us on Twitter. Bye. We have just been alerted by BBC News' wonderful app that Jeremy Corbyn is going to be automatically on the ballot for the Labour leadership. He won 18 to 14 votes at the Labour Party's National Executive Committee, and he is now going to be running against at least Angela Eagle. Fun times.
Indeed, yeah.
There were threats of a legal challenge from the Jeremy Corbyn camp if he weren't included. This was kind of expected, right? Do you think that it's right that he's being included on the ballot?
I'm not familiar with the intricacies of the rules, but it seems to me...
Aside from the rules, do you think
it seems kind of crazy that he wouldn't be included. He, you know, he was elected by 59% of Labour voters back last year, and it's, by all indications, he's roughly as popular, you know, perhaps even slightly more popular, because more Corbynites have joined up since he was elected. So I don't really see how you can not include him, just from a... I don't want to say moral sense, but, you know, it, at the end of the day, part of what the Labour Party is its membership. And if they overwhelmingly want Corbyn to be their leader, why would you block that through essentially a technicality? That just seems slightly bizarre to me.
Angela Eagle doesn't stand a chance, does she?
No, I mean, I think she'll lose.
And then in which case, what happens to the Labour Party? You were talking about a split earlier.
Yeah, so I still think that's the most viable option for the Blairites, because, or, you know, the non-Corbyn wing of the party, whether they're Blairites or Brownites.
Which is, about 80% of the parliamentary Labour Party, isn't it?
Yeah, it is, yeah. I think most non-Labour members who vote for Labour in general elections probably cleave more to the Blairite wing than the Corbynite wing, so...
But aren't those the majority of people who don't really think about politics a huge one?
Yeah, but, you know, politics isn't there just to serve political junkies and people who are really passionate and interested. It's there ultimately to serve the general public, you know. And that's the thing that we've seen in, like, the Republican race in the US, is that you've got a load of, and even in the Democrat race with Bernie Sanders as well, is that you have people on the fringes of politics who are very passionate and want things to change, but they're not they don't reflect the general consensus. Most people aren't that interested in politics.
Yeah. Do you think that this means that Angela Eagle is going to be running with anybody else? In terms of, do you think anybody else is going to run for the leadership, or do you think it has to be just Corbyn versus Angela Eagle?
Well, otherwise it will split the vote, won't it? Mm-hmm. And I think it's a winner-takes-all system, isn't it, in Labour? I can't quite recall. Do they have runoff rounds?
No, they don't. It was whoever was on the ballot, and then they all...
Whoever got the most votes. On, yeah, so it would be kind of pointless.
But then it was like you got a preferential vote, so second...
Yeah, you're totally right. Yes, well, in that case, I suppose it doesn't matter if someone else runs.
Yeah.
The only candidate who's vaguely stepped forward is Owen Smith, mm-hmm. who I don't know anything about. Do you know anything about him?
He's also of the vague left. So this is interesting, because this is all of the left of the Labour Party running against each other. Angela Eagle, it would have originally been referred to as, like, an old lefty. Mm. And Jeremy Corbyn is of the extreme left. And it seems quite odd that there isn't somebody who is of the centre of the Labour Party who stood instead of Angela Eagle, really, don't you think?
Well,
I understand why they chose her.
Well, explain why they chose her, then.
Well, because because she's of the left, she's more appealing to people who would vote for, who voted for Jeremy Corbyn.
Yeah, I mean, it's partly an electoral thing, and it's partly just a practical thing, in that you don't want to run somebody who, you know, you don't want to run a traditional Blairite candidate, because even if he wins, you've got a whole load of people within the Labour Party who you've alienated. But I think that speaks to the wider point that if you're a Blairite now in the Labour Party, Angela Eagle won't win. Mm-hmm. Even if she did, you'd still have a huge Corbynite membership. So what is really the future for the Labour Party anymore?
So I actually kind of understood the idea of Jeremy Corbyn having to seek nominations from the European Parliamentary Party and the Westminster Parliamentary Party.
Right.
Because the idea is that you have the support of all of the MPs, and that's how you form a shadow cabinet, and that's how you get everybody on side, and then you seek the approval of the membership. I understand that as a system. Mm. And so kind of bypassing that in this sense, and especially considering that he was kind of gifted some votes to make the conversation more broad.
Yeah.
Last year, when there was the original Labour leadership after Ed Miliband stepped down, I have a friend who works for an MP who is on the right of the Labour Party, and he was like, "Yeah, it's completely ridiculous that Corbyn would automatically be put on, because you need to have the support of the people that you're going to have to actually work with."
Yeah, but I do take that argument. It does make sense up until a point, and obviously we've seen all the problems of having a leader who doesn't have the support of his MPs. But excluding him doesn't make sense for pretty much, well, the reasons that I gave earlier, but similar reasons, really. Like, if you've got a candidate who's overwhelmingly popular among the membership, and I'm not saying, like, it's not as though he has 40% of votes, and the other candidates just can't get more than him, and therefore he wins. Mm-hmm. He has the majority of the votes.
Yeah.
It is a Corbynite party now. I mean, the group that backs Jeremy Corbyn, Momentum, like it's been described as a party within the Labour Party, has control of a lot of the machinery now as well. It's been a takeover. It's been a revolution within the Labour Party in the last year.
So you talked about, these are like people on the left-wing fringe. These are people who would probably usually align themselves more with like the Socialist Worker Party or the Communist Party.
Some of Corbyn's supporters, when they go to rally for him, openly bring Socialist Worker Party banners and stuff. So,
And that particularly makes them, they're never going to hit more than like, those kind of fringe parties never hit more than like 20% of the electorate. Realistically, you see the same thing on the right with someone, with people like UKIP. This basically means that Theresa May is going to be in power until 2025, right?
Potentially, yeah. I mean, it depends if she's betrayed by the Tory party within that time frame, which, after the past couple of weeks, is an impossible.
Who knows?
Yeah, but, you know, Labour have been in the wilderness before, and if you look at their history, Labour is the natural party of opposition, or has been since at least the Second World War. So in that sense, there's nothing particularly weird about it.
So speaking of the fringes and the people who voted, a lot of the people who ended up voting Corbyn, a lot of the people who were brought into the membership by this one vote system, and they only have to pay £3 in order to have the say heard, a lot of them are quite extreme in their views and will go to extreme lengths to have their views expressed. Angela Eagle, after she announced her leadership challenge to Jeremy Corbyn on Monday, she now has security protection because a brick was thrown through her local constituency's office. What do you think that says about the people that are now running the Labour Party?
Well, I said it on Twitter because people were talking about this, that the worse you think society is, the more immoral you think society is, the more it makes sense to behave in extreme ways in order to change that. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's not even an irrational thing to think. The logic of it is internally consistent. So I don't know that it says anything particularly about, like, momentum as a group. It does say something about the sort of people who are affiliated with it. Mm-hmm. And there are unpleasant people on the hard left. You know, if you've ever been down to one of the rallies, you'll have seen that sort of thing. Just sort of thuggish behaviour. If you've ever seen the group Class War, who are very hard left, they're the sort of people who like, create posters saying kill the rich or eat the rich or...
Eat the rich?
Yeah.
It's with a bit of barbecue sauce.
So, yeah, they're pretty unpleasant. But I don't know that it says anything about Labour as such.
How is it possible that... So Jeremy Corbyn does disavow and tried to distance himself from these kinds of actions, but it does keep on happening, especially with sexism. When he was running against two women, Liz Kendall and Yvette Cooper, they received a lot of misogynist abuse from people who said that they were supporting Corbyn. How is Corbyn so Teflon that those kinds of actions don't end up getting linked to him and it just bounces off him? Is it because so many people joined the party are from the hard left and so are therefore like, yeah, they're dirty. Liz Kendall is basically a Tory.
I think there's an element of that. There's also... I'm reading a book by... God, I can't remember his name. It's terrible.
By a gentleman.
But, well, I'm reading a book by this left-wing journalist at the moment. His name will come to me probably after the podcast. But he makes the point that throughout, like, socialist or British socialist history, you have this vein of sexism that runs through the movement, if you like, because class struggle is seen as more important than the struggle for gender equality. For instance, the Socialist Workers' Party actually had a rape scandal a couple of years back, where the like various women within the party lodged complaints with the party leadership, and it was eventually like put through a kangaroo court within the Socialist Workers' Party.
Excellent.
Because they are
the best courts.
The British judiciary.
One's run by marsupials.
So anyway, the British judicial system was not felt to be trustworthy enough to actually litigate, to deal with the problem. Mm-hmm. So that's unpleasant, and it has. And those are the sort of people that have joined the Labour Party in the last year or so.
So there are a number of people in the last couple of weeks who have joined the Labour Party, some say 100,000, and there is a dispute and musings as to whether they have joined to support Jeremy Corbyn or to get him out. Do you think that they are one or the other? They're obviously a mix, but do you think that more people are joining to get Corbyn out?
I heard one report, when you join the Labour Party, you can actually give a reason as to why you're joining, and a lot of people, a majority allegedly, have given the reason that they want to support Jeremy Corbyn. I don't know if that's true or not. There's been a lot of rumours and speculation buzzing about, but it seems to me that Corbyn has enough support anyway that it probably doesn't make that much difference one way or the other.
So I'm still a member of the Liberal Democrats, plugging away.
You think you're switching?
No.
Labour have great election prospects at this point.
No, I'm fine. With the Lib Dems, the only way is up. You're no longer tied to a party. Might you join the Labour Party so that you can vote? Pay £3. It's a bargain, isn't it?
Who would I vote for?
You're kidding, don't you? You can't vote for Brexit and then vote for Jeremy Corbyn. I have to cancel the podcast.
I wouldn't vote for Corbyn, but I wouldn't necessarily vote for Eagle either.
But if it was the two of them?
I suppose if I had to vote, I'd vote for Eagle.
Thank you.
Absolutely. But
Jesus.
I don't give enough of a shit to join the Labour Party to vote, because the Labour Party is fucked as far as I'm concerned. It is over. It's at least over for the next decade.
So you said that there was going to be a split, probably a new SDP.
I don't know there necessarily will be a split, but I think given the options open to the Blairites at this point, a split is the thing that makes the most sense.
If that were to happen, they could actually, if they didn't trigger by-elections, which I don't think they legally
They're not obliged to, whatsoever. No.
Because you vote for the individual. Lol. Yeah. They could actually feasibly, I think you mentioned this to me, they could feasibly break away from the Labour Party, form a new party, and then actually be the second largest party in Parliament and be the actual opposition.
Yeah, they can do that.
Do you think that that could happen?
So my idea for them originally is that they break away, form some sort of alliance with the Lib Dems, which gives them access to some local infrastructure, mm-hmm. which is absolutely necessary if you're campaigning in a general election.
Ask me how I'd feel about that as the Lib Dem.
How would you feel about that?
Fuck off. I think the last thing we need is another SDP.
Blairites and Lib Dems are essentially the same anyway. Okay, what's the ideological difference? He's looking at me, like, kind of questioningly. What's the difference between the two?
I don't know. I think I'm probably just a bit more territorial. It's less ideological, because obviously I have a lot in common in terms of my views from the left of the Conservative Party. I have a lot in common with some less crazy Greens. I have a lot in common with the right of the Labour Party. I'm pretty damned centre-y, lefty, righty.
Well, you're kind of centrist, aren't you?
I'm pretty damn centrist.
And Blairites are centrist as well.
I know, but it's the idea. So it all comes down to my feelings, Jimmy. That's you should know this by now. That's how I vote. And it would just be like piggybacking off of the back of the Lib Dems, and it would feel a bit.
I think they'd get if anyone's getting a raw deal out of that, it's kind of Labour rather than the Lib Dems. I think the Lib Dems are getting a slightly.
Yeah, but then if they were to come in and then run the show, it's then a party that I didn't join.
Yeah, I think there would be problems about that, which is why I think...
Because Tim Farron wouldn't be able to continue as leader,
wouldn't. But that's why I think an alliance is probably slightly more likely. And I think an alliance would be... Maybe you've got some sort of electoral pact where they agree to, like, not
contesting...
Yeah, not contest certain seat. But to be fair, that would be a minor concession anyway, partly because the Liberals have so few seats at this point, but also because Liberals tend not to fight with Labour very much. Mm-hmm. Like, a lot of Liberal seats, the ones they lost in the last election, they lost to Tories. And that's what you get in a lot of Liberal seats. It's Liberals versus Tories. It's not Liberals versus Labour, by and large.
But that's the reason for that is because people used to vote Lib Dem because it was the only way of keeping Tories out.
That's part of the reason, yeah. But also, the Lib Dems come, and this is the reason why you vote for them, is that the Lib Dems come from, like, an old, like... a very old party that used to contest things with the Tories back in, like, the 19th century, and they're far more from a conservative tradition than you'd necessarily think when you look at them today, but that's partly because of the SDP merger, I suppose.
Yeah. What do you think is the point of splitting from Corbyn's Labour Party to form a new party that is then almost inevitably going to have to... form some kind of a coalition if it goes into government?
What, with the SNP or something?
So if the Blairites would split off, join the Lib Dems, have a pact with the Lib Dems, and become the new SDP again.
You think they'd have to partner with the old Labour Party, the Corbyn Labour Party?
Because there was somebody at Question Time a couple of weeks ago who said if you put a red rosette on a donkey in Bolton, then they'll vote for it. And I think that that's true for an awful lot of people up and down the country.
Yeah, but is it a Corbynite rosette or is it a Blairite rosette?
I don't think that matters, as long as it's Labour.
Yeah, I suppose that's
it. The Labour brand is strong.
Well, rapidly weakening, I think.
Yeah, yeah.
I don't know. I think it's easier to be in a coalition with people you disagree with in a peculiar way than it is to be in the same party with people you disagree with. Because it's partly the psychology of petty differences. People tend to hate far more passionately their people who are ideologically very similar to them, but a bit different than people who are on the exact opposite of the aisle.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a kind of logic to it, like, we're on the same side, you should be fighting for the same things, versus you're on the opposite side, so the fact you're not fighting for the same things
pretty much sums up the Labour Party right now.
It does kind of sum up the Labour Party, but I think it would be easier to manage those tensions in two different parties than one different party. Well, sorry, the same party.
We're fucked, really, aren't we? We're not going to have an effective opposition for quite a while.
It depends how the Blairites respond, really.
Mm. Yeah. Cool. Anything else you want to add?
No, I think it's...
Brilliant. Listener, one last thing. You've already gone and followed us on Twitter, haven't you? And you've already checked out the website, haven't you? Because that's what I asked you to do at the end of the last segment. If you could go to the iTunes store where you downloaded this podcast, and you could leave us 5 stars, however many stars you like. I'm not going to force you to do anything you don't want to do. And then leave us a review as well. The reviews are really fun. That would be lovely. Thanks. I've been Jazza.
I've been Jimmy.
And this has been the Right Dishonourable Podcast. Toodaloo.